I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 20th of October. In recent testimony before the House Committee on Science, Space, and Technology, our guest this hour, who's director of SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Life, said, "We have reasons to be optimistic about the possibility of life beyond Earth. Earth-like planets, water, and complex chemistry have now been found in abundance throughout our galaxy. Everything that we believe was necessary for life to begin on Earth is now known to be ubiquitous throughout our galaxy and beyond. The race is on to discover whether or not it, in fact, does exist." Well, a couple weeks ago came word of a highly unusual star between Cygnus and Lyra constellations, KIC 8462852. Scientists have never seen anything like it, and many believe that the light pattern is consistent with a swarm of megastructures, perhaps solar light collectors. And soon, because of this discovery, we will have a much closer examination. We're delighted to have Dr. Andrew Simeon with us, director of SETI, Search for Extraterrestrial Life. He's at the University of California at Berkeley, got his PhD in astrophysics from that school, and now holds joint postdoctoral appointments at UC Berkeley, the Netherlands Institute for Radio Astronomy, and Radboud University in the Netherlands. His research includes studies of high-energy time variability, celestial phenomena, astronomical instrumentation, and the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Dr. Simeon. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk at WPR.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well at K Dunn Show. Dr. Simeon, thank you very much for being with us. I'm looking forward to the conversation.
Well, thank you very much for having me, Kathleen, and thank you for that phenomenal introduction.
I first read about this mysterious star in our galaxy in the Atlantic, and the story, you know, I read it at 2 in the afternoon, I think, and by 6 o'clock at night it was viral. It was just all over the place. When and how did you get news of this star?
Well, I suppose that was maybe back in about March or April when Jason Wright, who is a professor of astronomy at Penn State, sent me something of a cagey email that said that he had found something that he thought was interesting, that had actually been discovered by someone else that was one of his colleagues. And he wanted to know sort of what we would do from a SETI perspective with an object that was interesting. Mm-hmm. And slowly over the sort of next couple of weeks, Jason told me more and more about the object. And, you know, he was not sort of jumping up and down excited about it, but he certainly was, you know, appeared to be very interested in it. And eventually we scheduled a telecon with myself and Professor Jason Wright and Dr. Tabby Boyajian, who is a postdoctoral scientist at Yale University, who was actually responsible for discovering the star, or at least sort of shepherding the discovery from some volunteers that had been looking through Kepler data. So we had a telecon, and sort of right before the telecon, Tabby and Jason sent me a copy of some of the paper that they had started to write and some plots of what the light curve of this star looked like. And I think, I'm not sure how much of this you introduced before I came on, but basically this star, KIC 8462852, the KIC stands for the Kepler Input Catalog. So this is a star that was one of several hundred thousand stars that was selected for observation by the Kepler Space Telescope, which is a telescope that's designed to look for extrasolar planets. And the way that it looks for extrasolar planets is by watching the stars in the field that it observes very, very carefully. So it watches a few hundred thousand stars, and it looks for the tiny dip of light that we would see in a star if a planet passed between us and the star. So just imagine a planet orbiting around the star every 100 days or every couple of hundred days. If we watch that star very, very carefully, then every 100 days or a couple of hundred days, we would see the light from that star dip down a little bit. And it dips down in a very characteristic way because we have a round, dark object passing in front of a round, bright object, the star. And the Kepler mission has been fantastically successful at finding all kinds of planets, a diverse array of planets, Earth-like planets, small planets, planets that are evaporating, planets going around binary star systems. It's been by far the most successful exoplanet mission in history. And a part of that analysis of those data is a project called Planet Hunters, which is a project at Yale. And this project allows citizen scientists to participate in the analysis by looking through the Kepler data themselves. And Tabby Boyajian is the sort of project lead on Planet Hunters. So the way that this star came about is actually that some volunteers were looking through these light curves, and they saw a very bizarre light curve, some very bizarre data for one of these stars. And they saw that, I think the first thing that they noticed is that at one time, the light from the star was blocked by up to 20 or 22%. So that means that some very, very large object must be passing between us and the star, much larger than a planet. In fact, probably 10 times larger than even a very large planet would block. So that was the first weird thing.
And that's very, and that's highly noticed, that's highly unusual, right? 20 to 22%.
That's right. So in fact, this is the only star of the several hundred thousand stars that Kepler observed that exhibited this kind of behavior. But that one event, dropping down very, very low in light was not the only weird thing, and maybe not the weirdest thing. But there was a large number of very, what we call asymmetric changes in the light curve of the star. And that indicates that either multiple objects or an object that is significantly non-spherical is passing between us and the star. And all of this activity that I'm talking about was all observed to be what we call aperiodic, which means it was not periodic, as we would expect from a planet. So if a planet is orbiting around a star under the influence of gravity, it will have a constant period. So again, every 100 days or a few hundred days, we'll see this dip in light. But that's not what we saw from this object. We saw a very irregular pattern of occultations or drops in the light. So sort of back to this telecon that I had with Jason and Tabby, they showed me these data. And to be honest with you, the first time I saw them, I thought for sure that they must have made some kind of huge mistake. I thought that they must have made some error in their data reduction of the Kepler data, that the light curve that they showed me, as far as I was concerned, couldn't possibly be real. Mm-hmm. And so I asked them a number of questions, and eventually they convinced me that they had done everything right, and they had checked with the lead scientists of the data reduction pipeline for the Kepler mission and everything that one could possibly do to try to verify that what they were seeing was at least astronomical. So was at least not coming from the instrument itself or some kind of an artifact of the observation. And then we started to talk about various possibilities. So I heard, I think this is an important point to make here. I heard in your introduction something about that this light curve is potentially consistent with megastructures.
Mm-hmm.
I think I would phrase it a little bit differently. I think I would say that this light curve, this observation of this star, is inconsistent with any kind of reasonable physical model, and it requires quite a lot of sort of gymnastics to find a physical model that it fits.
Mm-hmm.
And so anytime in astronomy when we have something very strange that we don't understand, we want to sort of keep our mind open to any possibility. And one possibility that has been suggested that is very, very remote, but indeed a very intriguing possibility, is that what we're seeing here is due to some artificial structures orbiting the star.
Well, who thought that these might be megastructures that were built to capture solar energy?
Well, I think that idea came initially from Jason. So Jason is primarily an exoplanet astronomer. He does all kinds of work related to the detection and characterization of extrasolar planets. But he also works a bit on the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. And in particular, Jason has worked on what are called Dyson spheres, mm-hmm. which are hypothetical constructions that a very advanced civilization might build to collect a large fraction of the light from their star. So the idea here is that a very advanced civilization needing huge amounts of energy would naturally want to harness a lot of the energy from their star, and perhaps they would do that with large solar collectors. And there are various ways, including looking at transits, as Kepler did, that one might potentially detect these. So I think, you know, Jason is very open-minded about these kinds of things, and I think he looked at the light curve, and I think he thought to himself, well, you know, none of these physical explanations really, really fit real well. So what if there is a, you know, a fantastic explanation for this? Is there something that we can do to follow up on it? And, you know, again, this was not a, you know, there are ways in astronomy that if we are incredibly excited about something that we think is very, very rare or perhaps is some fleeting event, and we want to get access to a telescope immediately, we have ways of doing that. We can call up the director of an observatory, and we can say, you know, we need the telescope immediately.
Right.
And if we have a good reason, then we would get it. That's not what happened in this case. It was a thoughtful proposal for some observations that could potentially help to shed some light on what we were seeing. And you know, it's relatively inexpensive to do these kinds of observations. It doesn't take a huge amount of money. It doesn't take a huge amount of time. And this is just one, you know, arrow in the quiver of things that we're going to do to try to determine what's going on with this star, which, no matter what we discover, is a very, very interesting object. I think we're absolutely going to learn something about the universe and about our galaxy, mm-hmm. and stars and exoplanets from studying this star.
Hmm.
But whether we learn that we're not alone is not yet clear.
Right. Well, when he told you about the possibility of these megastructures, was your initial response, this is an absolutely wacky idea, or considering the work that you do, did you say, that's very interesting, let's explore it further?
Well, I think my response was mostly the latter. Professor Wright is a very thoughtful guy, and I know him relatively well, and he's not sort of prone to kind of jump to conclusions about things. And so I looked at it, and I think I probably had the same reaction that Tabby and Jason did, which is, This is a very strange object, and we should follow up on it. And you know, it is by far, I think, or at least by a good measure, the most interesting single object from a SETI perspective that we could study today. So you know, certainly we, you know, in searches for extraterrestrial intelligence, we look at nearby stars and we look at the center of the galaxy and all of the things that we usually look at. But I think as far as an individual object goes, I think this is a very interesting target. And as I said, doing the follow-up to search for radio emission that might be coincident with this star is fairly easy to do, and it's certainly worth a shot.
Mm-hmm. So do you have time now on a real high-powered telescope, or are you doing more radio transmissions, or how are you following up?
Right. So there's a whole suite of follow-up that's being conducted on this star with a whole range of astronomical instruments operating at wavelengths from radio waves, very long wavelengths, up through to very, very short wavelengths, optical light, and even higher energies. So we're following it up with everything that we possibly can. And again, one component of that is follow-up with SETI observations, search for extraterrestrial intelligence observations. And so what we typically do when we do these kinds of observations is we use very large radio telescopes, very large radio dishes, like you said, and we observe the, you know, a star for maybe 10 or 12 hours, maybe 24 hours. So Jason Wright has submitted a proposal to perform these kinds of observations with a telescope in West Virginia called the Green Bank Telescope, mm-hmm. which we have used for SETI in the past, and we're still waiting to hear the results of that proposal. So that proposal is evaluated by the observatory and by a committee of our peers. They look at the proposal and decide whether it's good science or not. And if they agree, then we can use the telescope.
I would imagine with all the publicity this has been receiving that they would say yes, wouldn't you?
I certainly hope so. I think I have heard some indications that they have received the proposal favorably and would very much like to see the observations take place, but we have not gotten official word. The one thing that we do have going for us is actually a recent infusion of funds into SETI research that maybe some of your listeners have heard about, a project called Breakthrough Listen. It's a project by the Breakthrough Prize Foundation, and that foundation has purchased a significant number of hours of telescope time on the Green Bank Telescope, specifically for the purposes of SETI.
I see.
So we're hopeful that if our peer-reviewed proposal is not successful, perhaps we can observe with the Breakthrough Listen project.
Well, I don't see how they can say no to this. It's too darned interesting. I read somewhere, Dr. Simeon, that if indeed, let's just take this out there for a while, because why not? If indeed these were very advanced structures that were built by a highly evolved society that really knew technology, what I was reading is it's so far away, 1,500 light years away, that we would have been in the 6th century while they were building solar collectors. Isn't that weird?
It is quite strange to think about it. That is certainly a kind of a paradoxical aspect of our universe, that, you know, there is a finite travel time of light. So indeed, we are seeing their civilization as it was 1,500 years ago, and commensurately, they are seeing our Earth now as it was 1,500 years ago.
Well, let's welcome phone calls. I'm sure that many of our listeners have been following intently this story. I just found it fascinating. Dr. Andrew Simeon is with us. He's director of SETI at UC Berkeley. It is the Search for Extraterrestrial Life. He's an astrophysicist. And we're looking at, in case you missed this story, this very unusual star pegged by citizen people who were looking at many, many stars in the galaxy. Unusual because of its light pattern, and they've discounted all the things that it could possibly be. And one of the more interesting things, because many of us on Earth wonder, are we alone? Is there somebody else out there in some way? But somebody did suggest, an astronomer from Penn State, that the light pattern is consistent with a swarm of megastructures, perhaps solar light collectors. And so he and Dr. Simeon and astronomer from Yale have been putting together a proposal so that the telescope, very, very powerful telescope in West Virginia, can spend more time studying this particular planet to see what in the world is going on there. So we welcome your phone calls about this or about the work that Dr. Simeon is doing in searching for extraterrestrial life. You know, it's interesting. It's always been fascinating to me. If you look up at the sky, you think, well, we've got all of these stars out there, and we do know now that many of them are capable of the substance of life. So how do we find out about all of this? Should we explore this? Should we go find out what's going on in that star? We can't get there, but should we direct some money and expertise to find out what this is? 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And we're on Twitter as well, and that's @KDunnShow. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's welcome phone calls. 800-486-8655. The director of SETI is with us this hour of the program at UC Berkeley, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. We had an email from Steve wondering why we always assume that intelligent life elsewhere would require oxygen and water and those things that we associated with life here on our planet.
Well, thanks for the question, Steve. That's certainly a very good question. So we call this endeavor the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, but really it's the search for extraterrestrial technology. We're not looking directly for intelligence or even directly for life. What we're looking for is technology, and if we detect technology, we assume that there was some intelligent life that created it. But it doesn't really matter what kind of life created the technology. Our searches are really agnostic to whether it's carbon-based life or silicon-based life, life like we have on Earth, life that uses water in the way that life on Earth uses water. Really, we're just looking for the technology, and we think that the way that technology developed on Earth, at least to some degree, developed in a similar way on other planets, and that other civilizations would have use for large amounts of energy or for electromagnetic radiation for communication and those kinds of things. So we're not looking directly for the life, just the technology, and we don't really care what kind of life created it.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Steve in Rome. Hi, Steve.
Yes, I guess everybody has to be named Steve today on your show. I'm a bit confused. It's a star that you found, and is that star generating the power that would be collected by whatever it is that might be circling another planet? Is that the idea?
Yeah, so at the moment, the only thing that we've observed is the light from the star. And what we see is that the light from the star seems to change in a very irregular way, and in a way that is not consistent with any astrophysical theory. So we don't know for sure what it is that's blocking the light from the star from our view. But the way that the light from the star is blocked is very difficult for us to explain.
Okay, so are you assuming that there would be a planet in relation to this star if indeed there's collectors? If I don't know if I'm making myself clear there.
Yes, yeah, no, I think I understand what you're asking. So far, no planets have been detected around this star. The only thing that we have detected is a very irregular change in the amount of light that we receive from the star. So we don't know what it is that is blocking the light from the star. There are some theories about what it might be. It could be a kind of a field of debris, comets, something like that. But it's a lot of stuff, because somehow it blocks up to 22% of the light from the star. So it's a very large collection of objects. And whatever it is, it's more than one of them, and they seem to be very irregular in shape.
Hmm. More than one of them is the key. That's what makes it very intriguing, doesn't it?
Well, there are two aspects, really. One, that they appear to be not round, or that there are many of them in some kind of a swarm. But also that they're capable of blocking so much of the light from the star. This is something that we don't see with any other star that was observed with the Kepler mission.
Well, it was a pleasure talking to you. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. And there were many, many stars. How many stars, the planet watchers, the volunteers who have been looking at this, and how many stars has Kepler had an eye on?
So in total, Kepler observed about 200,000 stars.
Goodness.
In the principal part of its mission, and this is one in 200,000, which is certainly rare in astronomical terms. That doesn't imply that it's the only star in our galaxy by any means that exhibits this behavior, but it's certainly the strangest star that has been observed with Kepler.
And in terms of SETI has been at this for quite some time. In terms of searching for or finding electromagnetic emissions from communication technology out there somewhere, do we have a lot of unexplained emissions that are coming, or are very, very few? We haven't heard anything from this particular star, have we?
No, we haven't. And occasionally we have candidate signals that we follow up on, and we're able to rule them out as being usually due to our own technology on this planet. Very, very quickly. So we have not yet performed any of our SETI observations of this particular star. As I said earlier, we're very much looking forward to it, and we'll see what we find.
Yeah. Steve, thanks very much for the call. And now, not a Steve, we have a Dan from New Hampshire. Hi, Dan.
Hi. Visiting Wisconsin for a few days, and I always love to listen to public radio.
Great.
This is a great conversation, and I was curious to know, assuming it's not a periodic pattern now, and I my understanding is that everything has to have some kind of an orbit. Would it be reasonable to think that at some point there may be a cyclical pattern that arises out of observation of this?
Yeah, that's right. Perhaps. So Kepler observed this star for about 2 years, 750 days or so, give or take, and no underlying periodicity was observed with any of the behavior we've talked about. There was no periodicity in these very irregular transits or these very, very deep dips in the amount of light that we got from the star. But if indeed there is some object orbiting around the star, we would expect it to be periodic. But unfortunately, the Kepler Space Telescope can no longer look at this part of the sky where this particular star is because of some issues with the satellite. So we don't have any way of sort of following up on it for another 750 days or another, another 5 years currently, unfortunately.
Mm. Tell us, you talked about pulsars and said that this is analogous to when pulsars were first discovered. What are pulsars? When were they discovered, and how is it analogous?
Well, pulsars are dead remnants of massive stars. So when a star a few times more massive than the sun runs out of fuel, sometimes it will collapse into something called a neutron star. And these things tend to be spinning very, very rapidly, and they can produce sort of a lighthouse of radio waves from their magnetic poles. And as viewed from a distant observer, these look like a radio lighthouse. So we see little blip, 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 blip of radio waves as we observe these things. And those blip, blip, blips can happen maybe 100 times a second or 500 times a second. So it's very, very regular. And these stars are very, very stable. So their period doesn't change very much. So it really, appears like someone is, like a series of radio pulses. And these were discovered in the 60s. And when they were first discovered, people saw this very regular pattern of radio waves. And one of the first thing that came to their mind is could this be a signal from an extraterrestrial civilization? And the first way that the pulsars were cataloged is with the letters LGM, and that stood for Little Green Men. And there was a period of a couple of months initially after their discovery where the scientists that discovered them very seriously considered the possibility that they had discovered extraterrestrial intelligence. And there's really a fascinating sociological story that goes along with that whole episode in the history of astronomy. So there have been other times, pulsars is a great example of that, where some new phenomena was observed that nobody really understood. And, again, whenever we discover something in astronomy that's difficult to explain, we want to keep our mind open as to all of the
sure.
The possible outcomes, all of the possible reasons why that might be happening. And certainly, as a SETI scientist, as someone who does SETI observations, it sort of makes a lot of sense to keep in mind that what we may be looking at is a manifestation of technology. And I would say that personally, I believe that it's probably most likely that our first detection of extraterrestrial intelligence will come in a manner sort of similar to the discovery of pulsars or the discovery of this particular star. It will be in an experiment that maybe is not directly looking for extraterrestrial intelligence, but just happens to detect it.
Yeah. Well, don't you think we should give it a better name?
Well, there is another name.
I've heard about that.
Right. 001. That stands for Where's the Flux?
Right.
Flux is an astrophysical term for the amount of light or the amount of energy that we receive from an object. So it's kind of a question, where is the flux from the star that we expect to see?
Yeah. No, maybe even something a little better than that, I was thinking. Yeah. I was fascinated by your testimony before the House Committee on Science, Space, and Technology at the end of September when, you know, every time you hear this story, it just sort of leaves you in a state of wonder when you talk about our universe being born nearly 14 billion years ago and giving rise, the laws of physics giving rise to self-replicating organisms. And then you say life eventually evolved a capacity to know its universe, to study it, and to question its own existence. Did this happen many times? If it did, how? And if it didn't, why? What a darn profound question. I mean, wouldn't you of all people? I'd love to know the answer to that.
Yeah, absolutely. It is an incredibly profound question. And, you know, we use the word artificial sometimes when we're talking about searches for extraterrestrial intelligence. But, you know, really, we as intelligent beings are a product of the universe in which we live. So we are, of course, no more artificial than a planet or a star or, you know, a rock or a plant is artificial. Our technology is no more artificial than those things. And the idea that somehow the universe has indeed evolved a capacity to question its own existence is, in my mind, the most interesting part of the universe itself. I mean, that if we don't understand that property of the universe, I think we don't understand the universe at all.
Our guest this hour is Dr. Andrew Simian. He's director of SETI at the University of California at Berkeley, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. And we're looking at this remarkable discovery, which we all learned about it just a couple weeks ago, this mysterious star in our galaxy that's emitting this very unusual, very strange light pattern, and nobody who looks at this very carefully and from a scientific point of view can figure out what in the world it is. So they've said, no, it's not this, no, it's not this, no, it's so many things, and there is what it possibly could be, and it may be a very remote possibility, but it could be that a very smart civilization, maybe extinct, maybe still there, designed all of these structures, megastructures, to collect sunlight. And so they're going to try to figure out if that indeed is the case and get a better look at what's going on there through a high-powered telescope. They're just waiting for that. Go ahead. And we're welcoming phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Scott is next in Minneapolis. Hi, Scott.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call,
sure.
Kathleen. This is fascinating. Doctor, you know, the question I had was, what do we hope to find using the radio telescope down in Virginia? I mean, will you really be able to define it any closer? I mean, this is not a visible object. You're doing this only through light observation. Is there any hope to get anything more dynamically clear of what the objects may be?
Well, that's a great question, Scott. Thank you. Again, there is a variety of follow-up that's being performed on the star, spectroscopy, additional photometry and optical light, so measuring the spectrum of the star, doing very high-resolution optical observations. And one of the things that we're doing, as you asked about, are radio observations for a search for signals that might come from technology. So what we look for in those experiments is electromagnetic radiation that is inconsistent with natural processes. So there are certain kinds of electromagnetic radiation, notably particular types of radio signals, that as far as we know can only come from technology. So those are the kinds of signals that we'll be looking for from this object. And if indeed we detected such signals, that would represent the first time that we have ever detected those kinds of signals from any star. And that observation, combined with what we're already seeing in the light curve, would certainly indicate strongly that there was something, some kind of technology in existence around that star. So while it wouldn't tell us a lot about what the particular use of these panels or objects might be, and it wouldn't tell us anything directly about the life that might exist around that star, it would be a very, very strong indicator that indeed there is a technology in existence around the star.
Hmm.
Well, fascinating. Thank you so much.
No, it is fascinating, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Completely fascinating. We'll take more phone calls in just one moment. Dr. Andrew Simeon is our guest, director of SETI at UC Berkeley. We're talking about this discovery of one of the more interesting things that people who study this have seen. It's a very, very mysterious star in our galaxy emitting an unusual light pattern that nobody can explain, and there is a need for a closer examination of what this is, and always a possibility that it might be evidence of a highly advanced civilization that has built structures that are creating this unusual light pattern or giving us the certain kind of light that we are seeing, which is very strange. So a lot's been written about this in the last couple of weeks, and there is a movement ahead, and Dr. Simeon is one of those leading that movement to get a telescope in West Virginia to look at this much more carefully to see if we can determine the source of this unusual light. It's just amazing. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. An astronomer from Penn State, Jason Wright, who is working and who knows Dr. Simeon, is saying that aliens should always be the very last hypothesis you consider, but this looked like something you would expect an alien civilization to build. The light from the star is consistent with a swarm of megastructures. The star is KIC 8462852. And the research group has renamed it WTF-001, what the flux. Flux is the measured light from a star that reaches Earth. Love this stuff. We'll take more phone calls in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go back to phone calls. Joel in Appleton. Hi, Joel.
Hello. Good afternoon. My question is, if it turns out that we think it is a sign of artificial intelligence, has there been any discussion about whether we would try to contact it? And if so, what are the risks of doing so?
Well, thank you for that question. That point is actually incredibly contentious in the scientific community, whether or not we should respond if we actually detect intelligent life, or indeed, whether we should be sending messages in absence of a detection to any life that might be out there. And opinions differ about whether or not that's a good idea, whether or not there are any dangers. Some people believe that it's sort of akin to shouting out in the dark jungle. If we don't know what's out there, we don't want to attract any, tigers or, whatnot that might be out there that might come to get us. Other people believe that communication is naturally sort of a reciprocal process. And perhaps in order to kind of join the galactic club, so to speak, we need to say hello. So it's something that people certainly disagree about. But I can say that for my part, I think what's absolutely very, very important is that there is a discussion about this issue. It's something that affects all the people of the Earth, and all the people of the Earth should have a means of weighing in on this subject. And I think it would be a bit rash for one country or one small group of engineers or scientists to speak for the world without sufficient consultation.
Hmm. Thank you, Joel, for your call. Chuck in Illinois, hi.
Hi. I missed the first part of this program, but my question is, how far away is this star? And going at the speed of radio waves, how long would it take for a radio wave from there to reach Earth? And since we've only had the possibility of sending radio waves for about 100 years, and assuming that humanity will exist in another 1,000 or so years, it doesn't make sense that we will be able to detect and they will be able to receive during the life expectancy of humans. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
That does make sense, Chuck. So this star is about 1,500 light years away. And so that means that it would take 1,500 years for any signal that we sent or any signal that they sent to reach us. And so that also means that the light that we're seeing from the star, or the absence of light, is what happened in that system 1,500 years ago. And if they, on their planet, if they are there, took a gigantic telescope, a very, very large telescope that could actually look at the Earth, they would see the Earth as it was 1,500 years ago.
Oh, my. That's just, you've got to pause when you hear that. As it was 1,500 years ago. Huh. Anything else, yes. Chuck?
My question is, and assuming that they sent it 1,500 years ago, and we sent it back in 1,500, and then they sent another signal saying, yes, we heard you, 1,500 years, it would be 3,000 years. There might not even be humanity in 3,000 years.
Hmm.
That's a very, very good point, Chuck. If we want to get in the business of interstellar communication, we need to take care of ourselves and take care of our planet, because it takes a long time.
Yeah. Well, there also, somebody was writing that maybe the civilization that built these, we're going out on a long shot here, but built these megastructures, maybe they're extinct.
That's also possible. There's a very famous equation in science, and especially in SETI, called the Drake equation, named after the astronomer Frank Drake, that characterizes the number of civilizations that we might be able to communicate with. And the terms in the equation are a lot of things that you might expect: the rate that stars form in the galaxy, the number of stars that have planets, number of planets that develop life, and so on. But the very last term is something that you might not expect, that very much affects the number of civilizations that we might be able to communicate with. And that's the average lifetime of a technology. If technologies don't last very long, if they only last a few hundred years,
mm-hmm.
and technologies are rare, then the chances that we would coincide with one in the history of the galaxy or the history of the universe might be very, very small.
Right. Huh. Well, thanks very much for your call. Let's go to Robert in Madison. Hi, Robert.
Hi. Yes, I'm wondering about the data. I understand that this data is highly irregular. I'm wondering if there's any sort of antecedent. You know, have there been any other stars that have been occulted to a high degree? And if those stars have been studied, and was there an explanation? And further, could any of those previous explanations or examples be interpreted in this case?
So I'm not sure I heard every aspect of your question, but I think what you're asking is had this star been observed before, and do we see any other stars that behave this way? And the answer to both questions is no. This star was, in fact, not identified before the Kepler mission, and the fact that it has a formal designation that begins with KIC reflects that it was a star that was identified for the mission. So it's kind of a nondescript star that hadn't really been studied in any detail before. And as to whether we see any other stars in the Kepler field that behave this way, again, the answer is also no. This star has singularly bizarre behavior relative to other stars in the Kepler field.
Jay sent an email wanting to know if it could possibly be a binary message, like a Morse code using light.
That is certainly a possibility. I think we don't have an extensive amount of kind of data points from this light curve that would allow us to pull much information out of it. But certainly, people have suggested that some very advanced civilization might indeed transmit a message using the modulation of a natural object, like blocking a star selectively, or perhaps potentiating the brightness of a star by using some kind of a neutrino beam or something to interact with the fusion that's going on inside of the star. But So far it looks sort of random, basically, and we don't see any kind of repetition that would indicate that there was a message.
Norm in Land O'Lakes. Hi.
Lake in the Hills.
Lake in the Hills. I'm sorry. Hi, Norm.
Hi. Hi, Dr. Andrews and Dan Kathleen. Could we use a Hubble telescope to study this star? And let's jump a step further and wonder, what would the alien intelligence want to use this technology for?
So those are both good questions. So we absolutely could observe it with HST. We have already done, TABI, Voyageon actually, has done very high resolution optical images with the Keck telescopes, in Hawaii. And we don't see anything out of the ordinary, aside from a distant companion that may or may not be, gravitationally bound, to the system. As to what the sort of occulters, let's say, what these bodies might be used for, I think one popular idea is that there are some form of a solar collector or energy collector that are designed to harness large amounts of energy from the star. They could also be some kind of space station or spacecraft or some kind of other artificial object that's built for some pathological purpose, but these kind of ideas are very much conjecture. Again, at this point, all that we know is that something very large and something very irregular is blocking the light from the star.
Yeah, and I've read that the first observation, if everybody says yes to you, that the first observation could take place in January, and then the follow-up in the next fall. But if you really see something that catches everybody's eye, the follow-up could happen a lot sooner. We might know more about this relatively quickly.
Yeah, again, we do have the proverbial red phone that we can pick up and make the call that gives us access to the telescope immediately. We have not done that. But if we learn something new about this object that somehow supported the hypothesis that there were indeed some advanced technology in existence around the star, we would pick up the red phone.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure you would. So where should we go? I know you have a meeting to go to. Where should we go to follow this story carefully?
Well, we have a website, SETI.berkeley.edu. You can also follow us on Twitter at SETI at Home. And I think if history is any guide, the media will be picking up this story very, very quickly.
I think you're right. I think they did. Yeah, they certainly have. Thank you so much for being with us. I just find it fascinating, and the work that you do must be wonderful every single day. Thank you, Dr. Simeon, for being with us. And he is gone. Dr. Andrew Simeon, our guest, for most of the show, he had a meeting to attend, and got to let him go to those meetings so this process can move ahead. He is director of SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, at the University of California, Berkeley. And he has other appointments as well. He got his PhD in astrophysics from UC Berkeley and now has postdoctoral appointments at that school and the Netherlands Institute for Radio Astronomy and Radboud University in the Netherlands. His research includes studies of high-energy, time-variable celestial phenomena, astronomical instrumentation, and the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. So tomorrow, I wanted to let you know what's going on tomorrow. Tomorrow, the first hour of our show, Robert Reich will be with us. He has a new book. He's the former Labor Secretary, of course, and his book is Saving Democracy. That will be at 1 o'clock tomorrow. And then at 2 o'clock, we'll be talking with two of the battlefield guides at the Gettysburg National Military Park. They're really good guides there. They're employees of the Gettysburg Foundation. And they published a book, The Gettysburg Cyclorama, The Turning Point of the Civil War on Canvas. We'll talk about that in anticipation of some of you listeners will be going with me to Springfield later this week, and I'm looking forward to that. Thanks to Scotty Myers and KP Whaley for producing this show and on-air production.